Money for heat.
We had a call to order the March 1st Ways and Means Committee hearing. I think we're one short of a quorum, but Representative Kelly, if you'd like to step to the stand and explain your bill, as soon as that we have a quorum, we'll start moving on our agenda items. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and I believe in the end here we will have the shortest bill of the session to date, but we do have an oral amendment. And did you say we do have a quorum? Can we move?
Are we at 17? Okay. We're waiting for a quorum, but we have the A3 amendment, which would delete the entire Section 1 of the bill, which would leave your repealer if you want to talk about what would be left of your bill. And as soon as we have a quorum, we will move your bill and the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you stated with the amendment, what that does is takes out Section 1, which is basically the school, the shift on the school payments. In light of our better news economically, we decided that that could be delayed. We do not need to include that in language. The repealer simply repeals 127A.46, which would also take away the ability of for the state to basically raid the school funds, the reserve funds, and stop the borrowing practices that we've done in the past. So that removes the ability for the state to do that.
All right, thank you, Representative Kelly. Representative Greiling has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question and a comment, and the comment is I strongly support the remaining portion of the bill once we have a quorum and delete the first section. And then I also wanted to compliment Representative Kelly on the amendment as well. In light of the economic, this whole bill passed unanimously out of the K-12 or the E-12 Finance Committee. But with the economic forecast, I'm delighted that there looks to be looking towards having better result for the schools by paying back the shift sooner, and I heartily support that as well now that we have this extra cash. So thank you on both counts to Representative Kelly.
All right, thank you. Members, we now have a quorum, and so we'll revert to our agenda items. The first thing on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from the February 21st meeting. Representative Norris moves approval. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Minutes are approved. The next item on our agenda is House File 575. Representative Kelly, I'll move approval of House File 575. Don't get the glasses on, my trustees are telling me. 576. And with that, I'll also move the A3 amendment. And as you heard, the A3 amendment will delete Section 1 of the bill, which was the school payment shift. And what will remain is a repealer of the payments of aids and credits and using school district money to help balance the cash flow of the state. Any questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A3 amendment is adopted. You now have the bill in the order in which you'd like to discuss it. You've already explained it to the committee. Are there any additional questions or comments on House File 576 as amended? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 576 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn, if you'd like to go next.
Yep.
Some members are, believe it or not that interested in the forecast information, so we'll get the bills done first. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chairman and members, I'd like to move that House File 110 be passed and go to the
wherever it goes, General Register.
General Register. Thank you, Representative Kahn. If you'd like to explain your bill to the committee.
Yeah, this is a very simple bill. It adds four members. The Pension Commission, which is the really only, pretty much the only word on pensions in the legislature, has five.
Yeah, that would help. We're having a hard time hearing
has
you.
Five members from the House and five from the Senate. In the past, that's usually meant that there's only been one minority member from each body on the Pension Commission. Actually, this year, the Senate, in their desperation to find anyone who knew anything about pensions, has already put two minority members on there, five, in the five people. But I feel comfortable carrying this bill because I carried it all the years I was in the majority. So it's not just the voice from the minority. And the House would always pass it, and we would always, unfortunately, the conference committee on either of either state government financer, we'd put it in, or of the pension bill, where we would put it in, always had a Senate conference committee that would not accept it. Actually, interesting political fact is all the members of the Pension Commission who supported this part were reelected, and all the ones who opposed it were defeated. So I'm sure it was the reason. But at any rate, the financial commitment is negligible. We don't have fiscal note says it's about you're looking at per diem for four more members. It's a $3,000 commitment, which is 0.5% of the budget of the Pension Commission and about 0.15% of the budget of the LCC. And so that's the kind of thing that we usually just tell them to eat it. So that's
thank
what
you,
I
Representative Kahn.
Do now.
Are there any questions for Representative Kahn? Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I didn't have a chance to catch up with you this afternoon, but why 5-2? What about a 4-3? Would that be a friendly amendment to you?
Well, we don't.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, since they have all, the bill actually says that there will be at least two members, you know, of the minority on the pension, mm-hmm. on the commission, and the you know, we don't usually set the members. That's decided. You know, the majority gets to do whatever they want.
So,
Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, what about at least three? Just balancing it out.
Representative Kahn.
We thought at least two was good enough.
Yeah. All right, I can talk to you further. Sure. Might be an amendment on the floor. That would be good.
You know, it's obviously it's good for us. Although I must say this has been a pretty... I'm not sure if going on the Pension Commission is a reward or a sentence, actually.
It's a sentence.
So yes, Mindy was on it once with me. We both... I do have a story to tell about the two of us. When Dee Long was speaker, she put both Mindy and I on the Pension Commission for the first time. And you're listening, you're going through all these bills and all this stuff, and you're learning all of these words and so forth. And at some point, kind of near the end of the session, I asked some really stupid question. And Mindy had this great sense of relief that I didn't know any more than she did. It was just that I faked it better. And she thought that she was the only one who had no idea what was going on. But anyway,
yeah. On that note, are there any other questions?
That's for the new proposed new members of the Pension Commission.
All right. Any additional questions for Representative Kahn? All right. Seeing none, Representative Kahn, would you like to renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion that House File 110 pass and go to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion's adopted. Thank you, Representative Kahn. The next item on our agenda is an overview of the February forecast with Budget MMB Commissioner Jim Showalter and Mr. Stinson. We're hoping we have better luck with our technology today than we did last week. So we'll see.
We've got a couple of different ways to present it, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, what was that?
We have hard copies, too, just in case we have to do the document.
Yeah, well, I believe the hard copies are in the packets as well. Everybody hold their breath.
Hang on.
Oh, there we go. Ta-da. Hey,
thank you very much.
Right, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. If you want to do your presentation, and then we'll try and hold questions to the end, I think that's the most efficient way to do this.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Pleased to present to you the February forecast information. What we'll give you here is a summary of the fiscal changes, some of the economic factors that go into this forecast, and hopefully can address any specific questions that you might have around this. Just to sort of clarify and process, the governor had presented a set of budget recommendations in middle of February. Those were based on the November forecast. This February forecast becomes a new baseline in which that budget will be repriced. It is also as the baseline in which legislative proposals will be repriced going forward, and is basically the outlook that we will use for any end of session and enacted budget numbers. I understand there was some question about changes that the governor has already announced related to his initial budget submission. He's articulated some changes that he wants to make to his budget, and we can talk about what the best way to transmit that is. Typically, the process is a formal letter from the commissioner of MMB to transmit specific information on the fiscal impact of any changes to his budget recommendations, known as sort of a supplemental budget package. We're in the process of preparing that, so there will be detailed work that has to be done to reprice all of his initial recommendations along with any of the changes that he suggested yesterday. So whatever would be the most convenient time or method for doing that, so the legislature would be happy to talk about and work through.
And do you have any idea time frame on that, your best guesstimate? I mean, you understand we have pretty rapid deadlines here as well, and so some idea. We won't hold you to it today, but a guideline, if you might.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, I would say that it's going to probably take 2 weeks. It's going to take at least a week to get the numbers together, just to understand literally what the fiscal impact, and then it's going to take some time beyond that, depending on how many things are changing, to put together sort of a balanced package with all the usual detail that you get in the biennial budget system, change pages and that. So we'd be talking probably middle March, and that's not unusual. In fact, that's a little bit faster than we normally are able to provide that information. But understand with the timelines that you're under, if there's any way that we can expedite or communicate at least preliminary information, we'd be happy to do so.
And we would appreciate that. And just, our staff pulled down a list from the NPR website. I don't know if you're familiar with that, if it's close to being the information that you think you're going to work with, or?
Having not seen the NPR website, I can't say for sure, but probably, yeah. He was pretty specific in what he wanted to change. That includes retracting the 3% surtax, which is, under the November numbers, worth about $900 million, holding back about $200 million of various Department of Human Services changes or recommendation cuts, pulling some of those back. Those, again, need to be repriced for this new baseline, along with a number of other smaller proposals.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, if we could revert back a moment to the timeline question. Today we received the timeline for the Tax Committee from Chair Davids, where he outlined the various benchmarks on when things were going to be done. Would you be able to share with the minority that kind of a timeline for this committee as well?
I will be able to do that probably in about a week. We are working with our fiscal chairs, and of course we just saw the numbers yesterday, so as soon as we have one that's solid, we'll share it with you.
Yeah, and I wasn't interested in the numbers at this point, but the timeline when you're planning to have various hearings and when you see the bills coming forward.
And certainly when we have that finalized, we'll be happy to share it with you.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you. So, presentation, normally our forecast presentations are very somber and detailed, and this probably would still be the same, but it still has good news in it. We are reflecting about a $1.2 billion improvement in the overall revenue and expenditure picture. However, we still have a $5 billion gap. So there's still a very sizable and very real and persistent problem that the state has. Most of the changes that we're going to talk about here today are related to the revenue side, often really attributable to changes in congressional action and assumptions that are in this forecast. And Dr. Stinson will go through those in greater detail. I think in all, we are seeing a certain amount of improvement in the overall economy, but there's still certainly risk associated with the numbers that we're presenting to you today. And in fact, in some ways, the band of confidence is a little bit broader than it is usually, both to the upside and to the downside. And we will try to walk through that as well. For everyone's background, you know, the forecast is the starting point, and this first slide is there. It gives you just some of the major pieces of what was included in this forecast. As I mentioned, most of the change was on the revenue side, about $984 million. This slide gives you just a quick breakdown of the revenues and expenditures, showing that $663 million is projected to be the balance at the end of this current biennium. That's certainly good news. It gives us at least a temporary easing in some of the cash management issues we've been looking at. Still going ahead, that 663 rolls into the next budget period, is used to offset some of the deficit in that period, and so we end up still with a $5 billion deficit at the end of this three-year budget horizon. That gap is around 13% of overall spending, and is about $1.16 billion better than what we had discussed when we were before you after the November forecast. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Stinson to give you a more in-depth understanding of some of the economic factors that are at play here and some of the revenue factors as well.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Stinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Commissioner indicated the revenues increased by a combined $984 million from the November forecast. $97 million are about 0.6% for fiscal year 11, and $887 million or about 2.7% for fiscal 12 and 13. That's not a huge percentage change in the outlook, but I'm certain that it's a welcome change in the outlook, and it's certainly welcome that it's positive rather than negative like it's been in the last few years. Some of this came from a change in the economic outlook. Some of this came from a change in federal policy. Both of these things were attributable to the December tax compromise that was reached at the federal level. The visibility, the most visible part of the December tax compromise was the extension of the Bush tax cuts. That was not a surprise to forecasters, and in fact, that had been built into forecasts for several months, and so that didn't affect the economic outlook at all, since it was already built into the forecast. What did affect the economic outlook were three changes that hadn't been expected. The most important is the 2% decline in 2 percentage point decline in the payroll tax, something that you're now seeing in your paychecks. Where your Social Security deduction is less than it was before. That, coupled with the extension for all of 2011 of the 99-week maximum for unemployment insurance, and the change in depreciation for 2011 allowing the expensing of capital equipment purchases. Combined, Global Insight estimated that added about 0.7% to their forecast. And that's more or less what other forecasters did as well. What we saw is an increase of somewhere between 0.7 and 1 percentage point to 2011 expected real GDP growth. If you look at the graph that's before you here, you can see that the timing of this really is largely loaded into the first half of 2011. There's a big change in the 2011 first half forecast compared to what was in the November forecast. And then after that, the changes are relatively small and relatively moderate. What you see in budget terms is that you have an increase in the base and then steady growth rates going on out into the future. You can also see that the stimulus or the stealth stimulus that we had here was such that it disappears in 2012. In 2012, real growth is expected to be 2.9%, the same as was forecast in November. This stronger economic growth was not accompanied by an increase in the expected, significant increase in the expected job growth rate or a significant decline in projected unemployment rates. Global Insight still expects a long wait on jobs. We're going to need to wait until at least the middle part of 2013 before employment in the United States gets back to where it was at the start of the recession. And even after employment gets back to where it was at the start of the recession, the unemployment rate is going to remain unacceptably high at 7.8%. Probably the most interesting part of this forecast to people that are jaded with the economics is what retaining the old capital gains rate did to expected revenues for the state. One of the changes that was made in the tax compromise was to extend the current or the existing 15% tax rate on capital gains on until 2012. Under current law, in November, the capital gains rate was scheduled to go up to 20% in 2011. And what that would do is the higher tax rate would encourage people for tax purposes not to turn over portfolios as fast as they would have under the lower tax rate. And of course, if they're not turning their portfolio over as rapidly as they would have under prior law, they would not be generating as much income. Since we do a current law forecast, our forecast in November was based on a 20% capital gains rate. Once that rate changed in law, we then reforecast capital gains. What turns out is that of the expected income tax, the expected change in individual income tax, adjusted gross income, the change in capital gains realizations between what was forecast in November and what's forecast in February accounts for about 65% of the change in income. Capital gains are only about 3% of total adjusted gross income for Minnesota residents. And so you can see that we've had a huge increase in a very small part of the tax base. It's nice for the state to get more money, but the capital gains read is a rather slender read to rely on because capital gains are very volatile. You look here at the next slide, you can see how volatile capital gains are over time. They not only go up, but they go down, and they go down considerably. The graph itself is scaled on U.S. capital gains realizations, but let me give you some Minnesota examples. In 2006, which is the tallest bar on the chart, 2007, which is the tallest bar on the chart, capital gains realizations were about $10.9 billion by Minnesota residents. After 2 years of declining stock market and losses and investor behavior shutting down, we lost about 75%, actually more than 75% of that. And in 2009, our sample indicates that capital gains realizations are only about $2.5 billion. We had two more than 50% decline years in capital gains realizations. Now you can see for 2010, 2011, 2012, both what the prior forecast was, the maroon line or the maroon area in the graph, and then the gold area in the graph is what was added because of the additional realizations that came about because of the lower rate in there. This, as I said, 65% of the change in the Minnesota resident tax base for the income tax came about because of this change in capital gains. The
Representative Kahn, if we can wait till the end, that would be great. Dr. Stinson.
The state revenues for fiscal 12 and 13, $500 million of the increase in state revenues came from the income tax. That's a 3.2% change in the forecast from November. Again, 65% of that was on the capital gains side. The sales tax, $249 million, up 2.8% growth. That's a little deceptive because $169 million of that was sales tax gross, the amount that was actually paid by individuals to retailers, and the other $70 million was decline in sales tax refunds, and it's due to a change in the way sales tax refunds are estimated. Looking on down the column to the other revenues, that's a little deceptive too, because we have moved receipt, we've changed the timing of the expected receipt of the final reciprocity payment from Wisconsin to fiscal year 12 and out of fiscal year 11. So all that was a shift from fiscal year 11 to fiscal year 12. Another way of looking at what the changes in the revenues were is shown here. 39% of the revenue change, $348 million, roughly comes from capital gains changes. 17%, $151 million, comes from other income tax increases. The sales tax change, the gross sales tax change, $167 million, 19%, sales tax refunds, 9%, and all other, including the corporate, 16%. What the composition of the changes in the tax base done really in economist terms is they've widened the confidence interval around this. We could be lower, we could be higher. In the past, we've been concerned that we had mostly downside risk. Now we think there's upside potential as well, but there are certainly major certainties or major uncertainties. The most important and the most obvious of these uncertainties is geopolitical risk, what's going on in the Middle East right now. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but today oil prices went up $16 a barrel from, to $116 a barrel from 97, I think it was, this morning. That's a pretty hefty change, and if that holds up, that's going to be reflected in gasoline prices pretty quickly. A quick rule of thumb about how important this is to consumer behavior and to prices is that a $10 a barrel change in the price of oil adds about 25 cents per gallon to the price of gas. And in 1 year, that change would reduce GDP from the otherwise, whatever its growth rate would be, by about 0.5%, and reduce employment growth from whatever it would have been by about 250,000 jobs. Another way of thinking about it is that 1 cent per gallon increase in gasoline prices costs or reduces discretionary income for consumers by about $1 billion. Now, the payroll tax cut that provided most of the stimulus and most of the reason for people to adjust their forecasts up totaled $111 billion. That's the cost of the payroll tax cut. That's equal to about $40 a barrel in gas. That insurance that we took out, if oil prices stay at $116 a barrel, we've used up about three-fourths of that insurance already. And of course, if oil prices go up to 126, that would use up all the insurance, and anything above that would be eating into the forecast as well. So that's one of the downside potentials, and that's a serious concern. However, on the employment growth side, we've seen a situation where really all the pieces are in place for stronger employment growth than we've seen up to now. And if something will set this off, we could actually have stronger employment growth than we have now. There's potential both on the upside and on the downside for capital gains. The stock market forecast that we use, and I'm sure you all want to write this down and go out and invest on it because this is really good stuff. But for tax year 2011, we have the stock market going about 12%. Now, the optimistic scenario has the stock market going 18%, and the pessimistic scenario has the stock market growing only 1%. And so there's room both on the upside and on the downside for the capital gains outlook over time. The bottom line is that there's plenty of reason to be cautious with this forecast, and this forecast certainly doesn't solve all of the problems in the state's budget. But there's also, unlike some of the last times that I've been before this committee, some reasons for optimism, too. With that, let me turn it over to...
I just would like to introduce
Commissioner
Margaret Kelly. It's her first time before this committee as a state budget director. This is her literally her first week. I think we now can round up to 1 week. She is going to be taking over for Kristen Dibdoff, who has been before the committee a number of times. Will be stepping down shortly, and Margaret is currently acting as state budget director and will continue in the future. I'm very happy to have her with us.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kelly.
Thank you. I'm going to walk through the expenditure estimates in the February forecast if you want to advance the slide. That's it.
Got it?
Yep.
There you go.
A little too far.
I know.
There we go. The story in this forecast really is about revenues and not about expenditures. There's just some small changes in the forecast on the expenditure side. They are primarily technical in nature. If you start on the first line of the slide you're looking at, K-12 education, there continues to be growth in enrollment estimates for education. but our estimates in February compared to November are that the growth will be slightly smaller than we had originally anticipated. I believe we were at about between 14,000 and 15,000 student growth in enrollment per biennium, and now we're down in the 13,000 range, slightly smaller. There's a small offset to that reduction from enrollment decline or slower enrollment growth in the equalized levies that property taxes at the local level did not increase as much as anticipated in the November forecast, and so those equalized levies are up a little bit in this forecast, offsetting the changes in enrollment. On the aids and credits side, this is all about a decline in aids and credits also relating to property taxes. The Health and Human Services side shows the most change in the forecast, and that's in the current biennium. And that, again, is technical in nature and driven by two things. First, the November forecast, along with the end-of-session forecast, assumed that the early expansion of the MA program would begin in January. And given the governor's executive order to implement that today, we've revised the cost estimates. So there's a reduction in spending on the general fund side relating to that time change, a corresponding increase on the healthcare access fund side with that change. There's also some additional general fund revenues that came from FFP relating to Medicaid payments. The enhanced FFP rate as a part of the ARRA funding is tied to unemployment. We had anticipated in November that the FFP would be reduced in the last quarter, commensurate with our change in our unemployment rate. An error on the federal government part meant an additional quarter of higher FFP for the state, and so about $30 million of additional revenue that we had not forecasted. On the debt service line, or I'm going to talk a little bit about fiscal 12 and 13. It's only a $9 million, I believe, reduction, $8 million reduction in fiscal years 12 and 13. There were some enrollment changes on the medical assistance, adults without children side that were offset by some reductions in expenditures for CD funding. So there are some changes that are hidden behind some offsetting uppers and downers on Health and Human Services, but all in all, a very relatively stable expenditure forecast for Health and Human Services next biennium. The debt service changes in the current fiscal year are relating to interest rates, next year relating to interest rates as well. Interest rates were a little lower when we went out most recently for our bond sale, and so we're seeing some debt service cost savings in the current biennium. Next biennium is all related to premium payments. When we do sell bonds, investors like to see bonds selling at about a 5% interest rate. When interest rates are low, they advance payments to us in the form of premium payments so that the interest rate over the life of the bond will be at the higher level that they like to see. Because interest rates are, we're forecasting interest rates to be a little higher, the premium payments that we had anticipated will not be coming in the way we had anticipated, and so there's a small growth in expenditures in the general fund relating to that. There is an initiative in the governor's budget or a recommendation in the governor's budget to change how we deposit premium payments so that you won't see a fluctuation in the forecast relating to interest rates the way you do now. I think the governor's recommendation is to use premium payments to buy down the bond sale as opposed to put it in the debt service fund to buy down debt service payments. Is that correct? All in all, a net reduction in expenditure of just $167 million in the current biennium, only a $9 million reduction in expenditures next biennium. We go to the next slide. We put together a little bar graph here to try and make an apples-to-apples comparison of expenditure growth from one biennium to the next. There were a lot of one-time solutions used last biennium to solve the budget deficit that masked the change in expenditure growth. And so if you just look at expenditure amounts, dollar-for-dollar comparison, from fiscal year, from last biennium to this biennium, a $34 billion expenditures versus $39 billion of expenditures it is a 29% growth in expenditures, but much of what we're including in this forecast had been assumed in the spending last biennium but hadn't actually been reflected in the amount of money we spent. And so the K-12 shift savings is pretty much the same level of service this biennium to last biennium. Because of that shift, we didn't have to spend about $1.9 billion in spending. Federal stimulus last biennium replaced general fund spending, but we were still doing that level of spending. Federal stimulus is running out, and so this biennium current law forecast, we still have those obligations on the books, and it will be using general fund revenues rather than federal revenues to make that spending. So a service level to service level comparison is a 9.6% growth in expenditures. I'll turn it back to Commissioner Showalter.
Commissioner.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Members, in conclusion, it's a difficult story to look at biennium to biennium. There's a lot of one-time factors involved in how we resolved the budget deficit last year. Ultimately, the question, I think, is before the state of how to get a long-term rebalancing of our revenues and expenditures. This last forecast, last slide just shows you from 12, 13, 14, and 15, the expected revenues and spending by year. As you see in fiscal 12, about a $3.7 billion deficit in that fiscal year that reflects the assumption of a $1.4 billion payback of a portion of the school aid shifts. After that, you see a relative stability in imbalance of around $2 billion a year, sometimes a little bit higher, sometimes a little bit lower. But that really helps to define the overall challenge for the state, that the problems that we have go back to the recession, and that the revenues that we lost at that point in time are permanently gone. That the revenue trend, even if it is increasing, is still going to be trailing the expenditure trend, which is still at a different level. So one way or another, we've got a significant challenge there. As we have in previous forecasts, though it's not explicitly part of the forecast, we are providing the effect of estimated inflation by year. It's a four-year compounded figure in this instance because there's no budget on the table. So it becomes a very large figure by fiscal year 15, but it is something for consistency purposes we wanted to make sure we included for you. That really is the end of the presentation of this forecast. As I say, it's good news. We're certainly pleased to give you a better picture of the economy and of the budget challenge that we have, but still certainly a lot of difficult work ahead. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. And we have a number of members that have questions. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Stinson, I really appreciated your thorough discussion of the geopolitical aspects of what we're dealing with here. You know, just today, you know, you mentioned the rise in oil prices. The market then responded, stock market responded by going down 177 points. And then I saw another headline on the way over here, civil war in Libya, potentially long-term and protracted. There's demonstrations scheduled later in the month in Saudi Arabia. So I think this situation is going to be a while before it finally plays itself out. And clearly, we're not going to see the oil cost of oil going significantly lower anytime soon. We were at $4 a gallon a couple of years ago, and I'm wondering if there is some kind of precedent when this kind of thing happens with our dependency on oil and its, you know, the multiplier effects to the economy, which you mentioned, a cent a gallon reduces income by, or consumer spending by $1 billion. When we had this spike 2 years ago, how did that affect forecasting? How did that affect, you know, the process that we're undergoing here? Is there anything we can learn from that as we move forward? Because I think this is very, very significant. And, you know, whether this market drop today is, you know, a blip or a trend, it's hard to know. But can we glean anything from when gas was at $4 and how that affected how we do business in terms of the state budget?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Ornstein, there are some lessons that we learned as in policy from the $140 a barrel oil, the $4 gasoline. And one of the lessons that we learned is an important lesson, and that is that the Federal Reserve needs to be careful about statements about what they might do because of impending inflation. If you remember, we had two things going on at the same time a few years ago. One was we had a really rapid increase of oil prices, which was due at least in part to Chinese stockpiling in order to have a sufficient supply of petroleum so that they wouldn't have polluted air during the Olympics. And that drove oil prices up and drove oil prices up very substantially. The Federal Reserve began to get nervous about potential inflation coming about and started hinting that they might begin to raise interest rates. And of course, once they began to hint that they were going to raise interest rates, people, investors said, well, if they're going to raise interest rates, you know, I'm getting out of the bond market because higher interest rates means lower values of my bonds. And so that brought the value of bond portfolios down and contributed to the financial collapse that we had. It came about later that summer, created margin situations and things like that. So I think the Federal Reserve is going to be more careful about its wording as to what it might do, having learned that lesson. That said, the economics are pretty clear, although there's a behavioral impact that we're not sure of, and that is, it seems like it's not just your people's reaction isn't kind of a smooth curve reaction. If you know, if gas goes up to 325, you buy a little bit less. If it goes up to 327, you buy a little bit less, and so on like that. There's kind of a broad band where you don't change your behavior. And certainly when gas got to be $4, people changed their behavior and changed their behavior significantly. The question is whether, having already been there once, that $4, that even $4 target is the same kind of a target, or whether it's going to take $4.50 or $5 or something like that to produce that. Most people think that $4 gas is a trigger point still, and so $4 gas, which isn't impossible at all, will change consumer spending, act as a drag on consumer spending, and slow the economy down some. It's an old story, but an increase in gasoline prices really is like an increase in taxes that it takes away from discretionary spending for individuals, and so it creates a drag on the economy.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just then a quick follow-up. So with this, in fact, likelihood, I guess, as you said, that we'll get to those levels again, how does that then affect, you know, this our revenue for the state? And is there any tools at our disposal to, you know, anticipate that? Is there a range in which, you know, revenue and expenses are affected by this? Because this is something we may be having to deal with much sooner than later, and I don't know if it requires rejiggering this or not. Or is there a way to kind of pin down what our role might be in response to that as we, you know, address this the next few months?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. We don't really have good rules of thumb for translating U.S. GDP growth or U.S. employment growth or U.S. GDP declines and U.S. employment declines into Minnesota-specific numbers. One of the rules of the thumb that we have, though, that we were using to apply to the Lockheed layoffs and also implicitly to the Medtronic layoffs, is that if you lose 1,000 employees and they make $100,000 a year, that's $100 million, and the average tax rate would be somewhere around 7%, so that would be like $7 million. So that gives you kind of a crude estimate for that. Of course, there would be reductions in sales taxes, and there would be spillovers again, but that's the kind of magnitudes that we're talking about.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I think you've probably given the answer to this already, but I just want it explicitly. Our treatment of capital gains is total conformity to the federal tax on that, in the Minnesota tax?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, no, our treatment of capital gains is not, what changed under federal law was a change in the tax rate applied to capital gains. Minnesota's tax rate applied to capital gains is different than the federal tax rate. It's the same rate as applied to income. There was never any change expected in Minnesota's capital gains tax rate, or the rate that applied to Minnesota capital gains. And so what happened is that we benefited totally from the change in the federal action. There was no cost, there was no loss in revenue because of the lower tax rate or anything like that.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Stinson. A couple questions. The first, I saw, I think just over the weekend, that national GDP for the fourth quarter of 2010 had been adjusted down from 3.2% to 2.8%. If you could just confirm that my recollection is accurate on that. And then would that have any impact? Would that give us a lower base? It's probably not reflected in this forecast, so I guess my question is, do we have an inaccurately large base from which the 2011 and 2012 projections are made?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chairman, Representative Downey, you're right that your recollection is absolutely correct that the fourth quarter GDP, what's called the advance estimate, was 3.2% growth, and then the preliminary estimate was 2.8%. There will be another estimate called the final estimate, comes out at the end of March, and there's always some variation in these numbers because the advance estimate comes out prior to all the data being collected, and then there's additional information that's provided. The change in the outlook from, or the history of fourth quarter from 3.2 to 2.8 would have a small, but a very, very small impact on the forecast. And the reason why is that the money that we have collected in the fourth quarter isn't going to change. We've already got that money. And so that's money in the bank, and then we're going to grow off of that base. We're not growing off of the GDP base. We're going to use the GDP changes in the future to grow off of the money that we collected in the fourth quarter.
Madam Chair.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Stinson, thank you. I guess that's slightly good news, huh? The base didn't go down because of that. And then the capital gains growth that we see, is that immune to some of these broader global uncertainties or the broader economic picture? I mean, is that totally indexed to the tax treatments that were enacted, or could we actually see, based on the economic activity, stock market declines, et cetera, a reduction in that capital gains amount as well? How solid is that capital gains forecast given some of these other uncertainties?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, if you look at the graph that I had up in the this graph goes through a period when there was no change in the capital gains rate. The capital gains rate was brought down in as part of the Bush tax program in 2001, and you can see capital gains went up and went up and went up, and then in 2007 there was no change in the capital gains tax rate, and it went down and down and down. So it's just very, very volatile. As I indicated before, if you take the baseline forecast for the S&P 500 and use that, you've got 12% growth in 2011 in the S&P 500. If you take the optimistic, there's room on the upside, 18%, that wouldn't be unreasonable. But you could, the pessimistic in this forecaster in February was a 1% growth. And what happened today, if it were to go on for several more days or months, you know, we could see another 20 or 30% decline if things were to really turn out badly. So there are no guarantees on the capital gains. The capital gains is just an incredibly volatile source of income for the Minnesota personal income tax.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I had two questions, and one is on capital gains as well. And with the geopolitical events in the Middle East and the reaction of the stock market, somebody indicated it went down 170 points today. You know, with the way stock market was increasing in recent months, would you foresee a major sell-off, which would mean at least a short-term tax gain for the state as people begin to take their profits?
Dr. Stinson.
In terms of, Madam Chair, what previous history has been, Dr. Stinson's a master at that, but I can see people getting nervous and starting to sell off and taking their profits now beyond what the normal expectation would be.
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's certainly one scenario. We have in our model, the way our model's formulated, it's kind of a catch-up model in that we forecast the percent. We say that there's a normal level of realizations, ratio of realizations, to the underlying value of assets, the base of in the gains overall, that over time there would be a certain percentage of assets realized each year. And then there are shocks that cause people to increase that rate of realization or decrease that rate of realization. Your speculation is a good speculation. It's as good as my speculation about what might happen in there. People may move out of the stock market entirely, in which case we would have a little bit extra, or people may just not have regained all the losses that they suffered beginning in 2007, and so they're getting out of the market, but they're still taking a lot of losses in stocks that they had there, and so we wouldn't see any net gain. It's, you know, if I knew the answer to your question, I would be a much richer person than I am now, and I'd even be willing to sell it or to tell you what the answer was after I'd taken advantage of.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just wondering if you knew what the history had been when things got volatile. I wouldn't be surprised if there wouldn't be a fair amount of profit taking. I guess I wasn't thinking of the people that still aren't back to where they were in 2007, but there's.
And Dr. Stinson, if you could speak more into the microphone, there are people having a hard time.
But my other question, Madam Chair, I indicated I had two. That was the first one. The second one was I didn't quite pick up. You indicated a reference to oil prices, and at a certain point we would nationally lose about 250,000 jobs, and the GDP would drop about 0.5%. But what I didn't hear was what that oil price was when that took place. I heard something about 40. Were you talking about if oil hits 140 or if it goes up $40 a barrel? If you could just repeat what you said earlier.
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, what I said was a $10 increase in the price of oil. So it goes from 80 to 90 or goes from 100 to 110. That produces over a period of 1 year compared to what was forecast would produce a 0.5% change, a 0.5% reduction in the GDP rate. So if the forecast GDP growth rate was 3% and the oil price went up $10 a barrel, the forecast GDP rate, other things equal, would be 2.5%, and that if that would cost about 250,000 jobs, which would be a really good month of job growth.
Okay, and that's, I didn't hear the $10, Madam Chair. That's what I was trying to clarify, so thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Dr. Stinson, question I have for you is, on the employment growth, I think I'm getting a little bit of a handle even with Representative Carlson talking about the reference to oil, but if it weren't tied to just anything, if unemployment went down 0.1%, is there kind of a ratio? How does that affect the state budget?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, we don't use that as part of our forecasting process of the unemployment rate. What we're concerned about is what happens to wages and growth in wages, and so we look at jobs and at wage growth and the unemployment rate. Because it can come about because people are no longer working or because people could be starting to look for work that had been discouraged, it isn't a good indicator of what's going on with the economy.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have another question. That's interesting. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, that you're on the flip side of the employment, not the unemployment, because that's a better and a larger pool to work from. The other one is the effect on our budget of the strong or weak dollar. It's a big issue right now. How does that have an effect or bearing? Maybe there's something else, too, but a strong or weak dollar. What's kind of, how does that interplay with our budget?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the strong or weak dollar determines the demand for U.S. goods, and that then determines the demand in part for Minnesota goods. But in our model, in terms of Minnesota activity, we don't separate that out. We let Global Insight do all of that work and see what it's, show what it's going to happen to the U.S. U.S. GDP growth and U.S. employment growth. Now, one of the reasons why Representative Downey's memory on the drop in GDP growth in the fourth quarter was that there were more imports than expected, and that means that there was less domestic production than was expected. More imports are because the U.S. dollar was a little bit stronger than was expected. So it does work through, but we don't have that as part of our revenue forecasting model.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Garofalo. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Dr. Stinson, on page 7 of the summary report, it references inflation numbers, the GDP, the inflation numbers from Global Insights for 11 and 12. As 1.9 and 1.7, and I respect the fact that in the notes they mention this is before the run-up in oil prices and Middle East crisis. However, there's been significant, I think it's an understatement, increase in commodities prices since the fall. And I'm just wondering, personally, your personal opinion, outside of what Global Insights is saying, what do you have any thoughts on where inflation's going in 11 and 12?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, as somebody who raises wheat, and has last year's crop still unsold, I'm really happy about the higher commodity prices.
Madam Chair, Dr. Stinson, just
Representative Garofalo.
For members of the committee, I don't think members of the committee realize how much wheat's gone up in the last 120 days. You want to share that with people?
Dr. Stinson.
Portland wheat, which is where I sell my wheat out of, is around $8, and I used to think if I got $4, that was a good deal, so... It's just, you know, it's just really good. Now, I can justify that, and along with Global Insights low inflation forecast, by pointing out that the price of wheat is a very small part of the price of a loaf of bread, and the price of corn and the price of soybeans are very small parts of the finished commodities. In fact, the prices of all the commodities that have gone up, the minerals, so on like that, are relatively small parts of the prices of commodities. And so while the commodity, or the prices of finished products, so while commodity prices have gone up, until you see labor costs go up, you're not going to see significant inflation or anything like that. The concern clearly is that... the combination of commodity prices and oil prices are a more tricky piece of the equation in there. Without an increase in oil prices, I wouldn't be concerned about inflation. If oil prices go up to $120 or $130 a barrel, I begin to get concerned about inflation in there. And so I think that the thing to watch is oil prices on the inflation side. In there, but it's hard to have inflation without wage increases and with unemployment rate in the U.S. of 9% and real, really global excess capacity in the workforce. It's not a concern right now.
Madam Chair,
Representative Garofalo,
and Dr. Stinson, in your expert opinion, why are commodities prices going up so much then?
Dr. Stinson.
Grain prices have gone up so much because we've had adverse weather events. Russian drought, for example, is, you know, you can almost date the start of the increase in wheat prices when the Russians stopped export of wheat in there, and that just started to the prices started to spiral. We've had weak production in Australia. As well, so there's a lot of events like that. I think the corn issue is a combination of weather and excess demand. I mean, I think demand is just outstripping domestic production capacity in corn. On the minerals, steel, well, iron ore. Copper, things like that. Chinese demand is there. There's no doubt about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. I have questions about the numbers of school children in the projections. Can you tell us what you attribute that to? I'm assuming you have a pretty good handle on the number of kids in the state currently, and if we had slower growth, was that migration out or less migration in than you were projecting, or any idea what we would attribute that to?
Madam Chair, the enrollment projections are based on birth rate. The changes in this forecast are based on actual enrollment numbers in 2010, and so I'm not sure what is underlying that change, whether it's migration out or just a delayed, fewer kids entering school, or fewer immigrants coming in than we had projected. I'm not sure what is relating to that change, but it's based on actual enrollment in 2010, and I can get back to you on the details underlying that change.
All right, thank you. And I think this question might be for Dr. Stinson. Going back to your slide where you show the good news of the 65% of the revenue increase attributed to capital gains, Maybe if you could talk to us a little bit, what maybe the bad news of that, in that wages generally being 75%, but showing only 15% of that growth. Do you have any data whether we're seeing lower wages or less jobs in total? Or, I mean, how do you attribute that disparity? Are there any factors that are more prevalent than others that you're able to ascertain? Or,
Madam Chair, normally wages grow, and they grow. Total wages in the state grow somewhere 4.5%, 5%, 5.5%, 6%. A certain amount because of employment, a certain amount because of inflation or cost of living adjustments to individuals' wages, and a little bit because people are more productive. Capital gains typically grow faster than wages, but they can also decline, and wages almost never decline. Total wages almost never decline. What's happened here is we've got just really spectacular growth in capital gains, and 4.5% to 5% growth in wages, which is a more normal wage growth. But we're just coming off the bottom of this 2-year slide from 10.9 billion down to 2.5 billion in capital gains, and so it's an oddity, and it's a thing that you need to be aware of, because it's where a lot of the money is coming from for this forecast. But it's what we think is going to happen. It's our best guess as to what's going to happen. It's just that we're trying to make sure that you're aware of the risk that's there. If we had 6% or 7% wage growth, better wage growth, we'd still have a huge percentage of the additional revenue coming from capital gains, just because it's a huge increase.
And as far as any trends in employment, are you seeing lower average wage? Or are you just seeing kind of slow regular growth? Or
yeah, Madam Chair, we're seeing wage growth and employment growth in the next 2 years at a little bit below what we would have seen in the late 90s and the early 2000s. So we're not seeing quite as strong growth, but we're seeing growth. We're not seeing a decline. We're seeing growth, and if I can get my book out here, in the in the forecast book, in a couple of places, we have what we have for wage growth, and for 2011 we have 3.8%. Last year we had 3.9%. So we're having about the same kind of growth in 2011 as we had in 2010. In 2012. 4.7%, 2013, 4.7%. So it's not that wages, total state wages, total state employment, it's not that those are declining. It's just that they're not growing as we were used to in 2007, for example, and the growth in capital gains is. The growth rate in capital gains is swamping the growth in wages.
And then just trends as far as employment or jobs in the different sectors. Are we still seeing a downturn in manufacturing and construction, and strength in government and healthcare? Or has there been any change in the trends in the areas of job growth?
Well, I'll give you the bad news first, and the bad news first is that construction employment is still struggling. Manufacturing employment, on the other hand, is doing better than the national average and is increasing at this point. non-durable manufacturing is the place where we're seeing the growth. The non-government education sector, so that's the private schools, the private colleges and things like that, that's doing better than the national average. Healthcare is growing, but it's not growing any faster than the national average at this point. That's been the place where we have grown faster than the national average over time. Leisure and hospitality, restaurants and accommodations and things like that is growing again, but is not growing as fast as the U.S. average. In general, what our forecast shows, and it may be just a function of the data that we're using compared to the U.S. data, and there's a problem of revisions not being matched up quite right. But in general, what our forecast shows is that we don't do quite as well in 2011 as the U.S. average, but then we do better overall in 2012 than the U.S. average, and we end up 2012 and into 2013 at a little bit better position than the U.S. average was in 2010. So we're really tracking the U.S. economy fairly closely.
Right, thank you. And Commissioner, just so you don't feel left out, I got a question for you tonight, too. With the additional money on the bottom line in fiscal 11, can you tell us what that does to cash flow? Are you going to be able to pay some of the university and school districts, accelerate payment back to them, or?
Madam Chair, good question. Our cash flow position is certainly better than it has been expected. Our current balance, I think, as of last Thursday, was around $1.3 billion, which was markedly above where we had been anticipating. We still have a low point coming up on April 15th. Basically, everyone will be asking for refunds up until that point, and anybody who's sending in checks then starts to go the other way. We're still going to be our low point estimate right now is, I think, between $600 and $700 million at that point. I think
in the red.
I'm sorry.
In the red.
No, to the positive.
Okay.
To the positive, and so we're, I think, comfortable with that, and sort of the level of sort of flexibility that we have within that level, that I would not anticipate any need for short-term borrowing this fiscal year. That being said, we have to balance the budget for next fiscal year, and how that happens and the timing of that will completely determine what our cash management strategies are for next year. In terms of repaying school districts, higher education institutions, I truly look forward in the next week or two to start getting to a place of having a detailed cash estimate, and as we get that and get that sort of staff work done, along with all the other repricing and all the other things that are going on, we'll then make some judgments as to how quickly we can repay those loans. All, just for the record, so everyone knows, any of the borrowing or delayed payments that we've done with other institutions will be repaid this fiscal year under any circumstance. It's part of our cash flow forecast. It's just a matter of time and whether we can advance that a month or two.
All right, thank you. Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, Mr. Stinson, you talked about inflation, and we're mentioning that until labor prices go up, it's not as big of a concern, or that's when you'll see a bigger driving force. A couple of questions. What is it when they call stagflation? Isn't that when labor doesn't go up and other costs do, and when are we in threat of that? And I'll couple my second question in with this. I've heard reports that inflation or the index CPI doesn't include food or energy costs. I assume that's fuel, but is that true that our inflation numbers don't include those main parts of our everyday life?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, let me answer your last question first. there are a number of inflation indexes, and the most common one that people have heard of is something called the Consumer Price Index, or the CPI. That includes both food and energy. However, because those two components are very volatile, some people are interested in knowing what would happen, what's happening to everything other than food and energy. And so there is a second index called the core index, or core CPI, or CPI less food and energy, that's also published. And so you can see what part of the inflation that's going on is due to food and energy, what part of it's not due to food and energy. Now, with respect to your question about stagflation, stagflation is no economic growth and high inflation. It's something that we saw in the 70s. It typically comes from a shift in the supply curve, and what we have is you end up in the worst of all situations with inflation and no economic growth in there. That doesn't appear to be a concern at this point, and the reason why I say doesn't appear to be a concern at this point, this oil situation is certainly a threat, and it was certainly the spark that drove the stagflation in the 70s. So that's certainly a concern. We're also in a, not, I wouldn't say precarious situation, but in a risky situation for another reason, for two other reasons, and that is that in order to keep the Great Recession from turning into a second Great Depression, two things happened. One is the Federal Reserve increased liquidity enormously. They pumped a lot of money into the system. And second, the federal deficit was increased substantially. One of the things, or actually two of the things that economists think that they know, is that increases in the money supply, large increases in the money supply, yield inflationary pressures, or can produce inflation, and large increases in the federal budget deficit can produce large increases in inflation. Most economists think that once the economy is on a little bit firmer footing, that the Federal Reserve will begin to raise interest rates and will actually end up with interest rates higher than they would have had there not been all the increase in the money supply and an increase in the federal budget deficit. And so they will slow the economy down a little bit more than would normally have been effective. One can imagine a situation where everything spirals out of control, and because of the higher energy prices, the Federal Reserve begins to act, and act more quickly than they would have otherwise, and that would then slow the economy down, and so we could get the scenario that you have. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's a legitimate concern.
Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, to the CPI and the core CPI, what are those numbers most recently? What generally is? Do you know those off the top of your head, or fairly readily? And I guess that's probably it for now.
Dr. Stinson.
My impression is the most recent CPI numbers like 1.9% or something like that, and the core number is like 2.2%, but those are just off the top of my head. They aren't, you know, we're not talking about the 1970s or the early 1980s in terms of what's going on in inflation at this point from the CPI or the core of CPI.
Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, that did remind me of my last question that I wasn't remembering the last time. Dr. Stinson, Representative Groffalo asked about what's causing high commodity prices. Does the falling dollar have any effect on our state and our investments, and does that have any effect on the commodities, or is it just simply a trend we see periodically, and it doesn't have any effect on the commodity and the trading going on? You hear some say that the dollar's on a course of doom and gloom. Any response to that, and should we be worried about that, or is that more worry than we need to be worried about?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chairman, Representative Westrom, the falling dollar, or the decline in the dollar, does help commodity prices because it makes U.S. produced corn and wheat and soybeans and iron ore and things like that less expensive in foreign countries, and so it expands our market. Back in the 1980s, the early 1980s, when we had the farm crisis, part of the cause of the farm crisis was a higher valued dollar, which priced U.S. commodities out of foreign markets, and so that's part of what was going on in there.
Representative Westrom. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stinson, looking at the future in the economy, how does the baby boom generation and the loss of World War II veterans play into the picture demographically?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chairman, Representative Anderson, the demographics are actually potentially, are sources of both concern and for reasons for potential optimism as well. If I tell you that it's not going to be until 2013 that we get back to the same level of employment as we had in 2007, and that the unemployment rate is going to be 7.8% in 2013, that sounds like a bad scenario. That's not something that you would hope for or anything like that. However, because of the peculiar demographic nature of the next few years, where we're going to have this huge increase in the number of people turning age 65, this year we'll have about 30% more people in the workforce turning age 65 than did last year. That's going to open up jobs. These people are going to retire sometime in the next couple or 3 years, it's very likely. And that's going to open up jobs, not as replacement jobs. We're not going to need jobs created, but we'll have additional demand for workers as replacement workers. And so that's one reason why state demographer Tom Gillespie and I are more optimistic than the national forecasters about what's going to happen to the unemployment rate. In a lot of industries in this state, about two-thirds of the job openings that are going to occur between now and 2020 are going to be replacement jobs as opposed to new jobs created. And that will be a significant source of employment for people that are already unemployed or currently unemployed, or people that are going to be entering the workforce. So that's the good side of it. Now, of course, the bad side of it is that there are going to be additional demands for services by the senior citizens or the people that are retiring, and we're going to have to figure out a way to make them to meet their needs at a reasonable cost. And in the long term, not the long term, the 10-year forecast that was produced in the middle of January, there's a telling graph, and the telling graph is shows what the cost of health care is by age cohort. And the cost of health care for people 55 to 65, 65 to 75, and 75 above and above is substantially, you know, two and three times higher than the average cost of health care. And, of course, that's where the population growth is going to be, is in those cohorts. And so that's going to be a real challenge.
Representative Anderson? Any other questions for Commissioner? All right, well, thank you very much for staying late tonight. We appreciate your willingness to do that. And if there's no other questions, the meeting's adjourned.